Good evening. Welcome. Thanks for joining us. Special thank you to our guest this evening, a Talmud Chacham, a Manhig Rav Yisrael, renowned psychologist, and to me personally, a Chaver Tov, a good friend, Rabbi Dr. Jonathan Schwartz, Rav of Congregation Adas Israel of the JEC in Elizabeth Hillside, the clinical director of the Center for Anxiety Relief in Union, New Jersey, and a well-known expert on anxiety disorders and obsessive-compulsive disorders, and particularly its intersection with the Orthodox Jewish community. Our format will be mostly question and answer. I'll present issues and questions to Dr. Schwartz for his response, and we'll also field questions as well live via email. You can submit questions to projectometz@bnei.org, projectometz at bnei, B-N-A-I, Yeshurun, Y-E-S-H-U-R-U-N, .org. We will not be able to get to all of the questions, but we will certainly try to get to as many as possible. My name is Ari Zatz. I'm the Assistant Rabbi at Congregation B'nai Yeshurun in Teaneck and co-founder of Project Ometz together with Alyssa Horn. Our goal in establishing Project Ometz was to provide support for families of children with mental health issues. Our parent mentor volunteers are available to speak and to be paired up with those who need support. They have all been down this road with their own children with mental health issues, and Baruch Hashem are far along the path with a wealth of knowledge, willing and very able to help. We're not a referral service. Relief is a tremendous community resource that already does that exceptionally well, but we are here to help and support. The second prong of support is informational and educational, to try and reduce the stigma that surrounds mental illness. And that's what this phone call is about, and that's what the previous phone call was about as well. The response the last time we did a phone call back in February was overwhelming. People begging for more, asking us to cover more topics and to try to do this more frequently. We hope over the course of the coming months to try and do 4 more teleconferences on a variety of topics, and we hope as well at least to do 1 live lecture at some point a little later in the year. Our focus this evening is on anxiety and obsessive-compulsive disorder, and they seem to be prevalent in our community. And part of what fascinates me is that the fundamental traits are unquestionably Torah values. The idea of anxiety, nervousness, concern in our Avodas Hashem is a positive. Chazal in several places refer to someone whose libo nokfo, whose heart is pulling at him with a certain concern that they may have done an aveir, they may have done something wrong. We have a korban, the Ashem Toloi, that's brought on a suffik aveira, on a doubt whether somebody did an aveira or not, if a person's not sure. Rashi, on the opening daf of Masechta Shavuos, the daf Yom we just began learning last week, comments that the role of the seer Lashem, the seer which is brought, the special korban brought in on Yom Kippur, and even Yom Kippur itself, is to bring atonement for one who sins and is unaware of it. And the language Rashi writes is she'af al pi she'eino yodea shechata yesh lo lidog. Even though he doesn't know with certainty that he has sinned, he should still be worried. So apparently there's a type of worry that's a healthy one. And certainly the idea of Seder as well, of being neat, is lauded by the Bali Musar as a fundamental midah tova. In chaos, one cannot grow in one avodas Hashem. There's a famous story of the Alter Mikelm, who once went to visit his son in yeshiva at a distance. And the first thing the father did when he got to yeshiva was not to talk to his son's rebbe, not to see what he was learning, but he went to his son's room. On inspection, he found the boy's possessions, everything was neat, everything was in order, and from that he was very confident that his son was doing well in yeshiva. If things are organized in one's external life, then it's much easier to have them organized in one's head as well. Rav Volbi would also quote from the Altar of Chem that Seder, this midah of being orderly, can be compared to the clasp of a necklace. That the value of the necklace itself could be much greater, but if you don't have that clasp, if you don't have something that's holding it together, then everything else becomes scattered. It's something which serves that fundamental purpose of binding together all of the other things that we do. But clearly both traits in an extreme are unhealthy and even dangerous. The Rambam in Hilchos Deos tells us that we need to find the Shvil HaZahav, we have to find the Midah Beinonis, the middle of the road, the happy medium and the balance of Midos. And clearly this is such a case where the basic trait is important, but excess is not even a question of midos, but it's a question of potentially a disorder, whether it be anxiety, whether it be obsessive compulsive disorder. And perhaps at the opening, that's something that Dr. Schwartz can enlighten us about. We've merged together today the topics of obsessive compulsive disorder and anxiety. And the question is there really a connection between the two? Should these topics be merged together? And if there is a connection, what is that connection?
First of all, that's a beautiful introduction, Rabbi Zatz, and I want to thank you and Mrs. Horn for inviting me to join you today. Let's first begin by noting where things are different. You talked so beautifully about fear and about order and seder, about all these different ideas that seem to make sense in our minds. But there's a difference between having an order and a seder and the reason behind why you're doing it. There's a difference between having healthy Yerushalayim and striving for healthy Yerushalayim and getting stuck in a situation where the fear so grips an individual that the individual can't function. Everybody has fears. That's to be expected. But anxiety and anxiety disorders happen when the fear becomes misplaced, when the fear becomes excessive, when the fear becomes disconnected from reality and no longer signals immediate danger. So what you're dealing with on the one hand is a prolonged, complex state, usually in anticipation that something or someone is going to produce a situation that will be totally uncontrollable. So in a child's case, the child may be walking around and saying to himself or herself, I'm so scared of a dog. I see dogs everywhere. Or those turkeys that sometimes you see walking up and down Winthrop. You sometimes turn around and think to yourself, I'm so scared of turkeys. If I walk into the supermarket Thanksgiving time, I'm already feeling heart palpitations. There's a difference between the turkey nibbling on your leg, which may provide a healthy fear for a child at an appropriate age, and the uncontrollable anxiety that makes one fearful when November comes around and people start getting scared of Thanksgiving. People who get involved in anxiety-style thinking, whether it be a panic disorder, a specific phobia, school refusal, generalized anxiety, social phobia, they'll often use avoidance, an extreme avoidance. It's not just the flutter in the heart. It's the fact that the person is not able to go ahead and engage in the proper ways of heading into Yerushalayim. So that's where anxiety sort of gets us on the first hand. And then you mentioned obsessive-compulsive disorder, which is very different. You looked at some of the comparisons on the surface, seder, order, perhaps a certain degree of zeal, and performance of mitzvos. That's great and wonderful when it's healthy, when it's a focused, healthy ideal that somebody is striving for within one's life. But when all of a sudden you have a situation that consumes you, when you have a pattern of unwanted and intrusive and all-controlling thoughts, which we call obsessions, they pop up, and they all of a sudden create major crises for people, and they produce anxiety. And then whoever is suffering with those obsessions will engage in all sorts of behaviors, not because they want to be mesudar, not because they want to have order within their lives, but because they are assuming for whatever reason doing these different activities will stay off that anxiety. And all of a sudden we have to start worrying about things like OCD. Anxiety disorders and OCD, which we've pointed out, are really very much interrelated. In the olden days, that is to say within the last 2 years, they were all part of the anxiety disorder cluster. They would be very closely related. Both involved anxiety. They're all time-consuming. Here's the magic word. They all cause not order, but disorder. They disrupt life. They disrupt normal routine. And they make frustration. They'll seem bizarre. If they're all in that category, we need to stop and ask ourselves, what's going on with our kids? What's going on in that situation, and what do we want to do about it?
Very interesting. Thank you. Maybe just to follow up in a little bit more detail, you know, as a parent, so when, you know, should something go off in my mind that there's a problem? People are anxious all the time. My child is anxious for an exam. There's a lot of pressure in school. When is it something which is to be expected? When is a person maybe just to double up on it, you know, orderly or perfectionist? And when, as a parent, should I be start being nervous that maybe my child's conduct is something which touches or at least should be examined as potentially a disorder?
That's another great question. The truth is, the easiest and first test is when the child says so. If a child sees a problem within himself or herself, and you'll see this more sometimes with adolescents, where the child says, I'm so anxious. I can't calm myself down. I can't catch my breath. You better stop and ask what's going on in that situation. And sometimes just saying so creates the very first flag and something you want to pay attention to. The other thing I would want to point out is I mentioned that magic word before, disorder. That is to say, life is not in order. That is to say, it's disruptive to the child's routine. If you're in that situation, you're going to want to go ahead and figure out what's going on over here. It's not within the realm of order. I mean, let's be honest, practitioners and researchers, we look at four major ideas when we start evaluating this issue. I call them the degrees. So degree number one is the degree of control over the behavior. If the child's freaking out because the child has an English test, and, you know, it's kind of hard to deal with English tests, and you never know what the teacher wants, you never know what's going to happen with the essay, and your child is very concerned about grades because, after all, everybody wants to get that into that wonderful seminary or college or program and earn whatever scholarship he or she can. But you know what? Bottom line is, when sat down, taking a break, finding out, the child's able to find some degree of mastery, some sense of calm. They're able to go ahead and show control over the panic. Then you're probably not talking about an anxiety disorder. If you're turning around and using the question of the degree of distress from the behavior, if we measure how out of the norm is this for the child, how much distress is the child in? If the child has a concern, let's say, over orderliness or contamination, nobody wants to get sick, especially not the week before vacation. But when a child turns around and says, oh my gosh, I'm so nervous, I can't go to sleep unless I wash my hands, you know, 26 times because there may be a little bit of whatever Shlomo touched in school, and Shlomo now has the flu, and I've been home for 6 hours already since school ended, and I still can't sleep because I didn't wash my hands enough, then all of a sudden we have to stop and ask ourselves, Shlomo's distress, our child's distress from the behavior of washing is something that we want to look into. What's the degree of impairment? So we've talked about the degree of control, the degree of distress, and now how far is that child's behavior holding himself or herself back? If the child can't turn around and say Shema, and as a result davens for 14 hours, or misses three periods because the Rebbe in school or the Mora in school is scared to tell the child not to daven, but the child misses Chumash and Navi, and now all of a sudden is trying to catch up in order to get to math on time, then we're probably talking about a certain major degree of impairment. And, of course, there's also the duration and time. So, again, we're talking about a degree of control over the behavior, a degree of distress from behavior, a degree of impairment, and just the amount of time spent on the anxiety. Those are the types of things we start to look at when we ask ourselves, when is it a problem as a parent?
You've defined so well for us the details of what to potentially be concerned about, but how prevalent is it, and what are the different treatment options if one does find themselves in a situation in which they need to take care of a loved one who seems to be suffering?
This is always my really difficult question. I'm a practitioner, so today I actually went back out of curiosity and checked out the numbers, knowing I was going to be here. And believe it or not, and as of last year, some of the studies that were published last year, the National Institute of Mental Health identified that in 25.1% of adolescents, we can find some degree of some diagnosable anxiety disorder. That's a huge number. That means one out of every four children in the United States of America meets some diagnosis somewhere for an anxiety disorder. And as far as we were concerned, I believe the same National Institutes of Mental Health published a study that recommended that not 21% of the population of children in the United States exhibit some form of obsessive compulsive disorder. Now, again, you don't have to have every single diagnostic category to have OCD. I'm sure we'll talk about that in a little bit. There are subdivisions of OCD. And to see, you know, such a large number, you're talking about one out of five, that's a very, very prevalent disorder or prevalent degree of impairment within United States society. And what do we do about it? So, again, there are multiple approaches. There is a medicinal approach where we are very often psychiatrists and sometimes pediatricians, though if it were up to me and it was my child, I'd want to make sure to go to somebody who has an expertise. We're dealing with our children. They're our most precious resource. And I would want to make sure that if somebody was working with a psychiatrist, to make sure that the person with the psychiatrist would have some degree of mastery over obsessive-compulsive disorder. Then very often we're dealing with anti-anxiety medications, but more and more prevalently we're seeing SSRIs or serotonin-specific reuptake inhibitors. Basically, we're talking about the newer classification of drugs that were once identified as Prozac, Zoloft, and nowadays there are even more common ones, Wellbutrin, Luvox, just to name a couple of them on the that tend to come up. And those would be prescribed by a medical professional. It is very rare for the for a medical professional to turn around and recommend just medical treatment alone. Studies show that a combo or even a degree of work with the therapist alone, depending on the severity of the case, though it tends to show much, much better results than just medication by itself. When we talk about different approaches to therapy, there's not one shoe that fits all. But say, you know, the Consumer Reports study of the early 2000s seemed to show the Consumer Reports study in the 2000s showed the one area that people had a preference was in terms of therapeutic approaches was in the anxiety disorders where cognitive behavioral therapy tend to show a better result slightly, but a better result statistically significant as an approach to treating anxiety disorders. And so you're talking about somebody who is an expert in anxiety disorders, and hopefully when you're looking for a therapist, somebody who has expertise in dealing with anxiety disorders and OCD, not just CBT, I know a little bit. You want to interview somebody and ask them, how long have you been treating this? What's your approach? You want to hear letters like ERP, exposure response prevention. You want to find out about things like homeworks. How is the child going to work? And you want to be able to offer ideas and perspective to find out where your role as a parent is. And again, that all comes out when you get a chance to interview a good therapist.
There's a term out there that's called scrupulosity, relating to obsessive-compulsive disorder in religious practice. And I guess the question is, does religious life, with its great concern for detail, we're very careful about Zman, and we're very careful about the, you know, sitting at the Seder with the, you know, chart to figure out what exactly a Kazayas is and the Kibetza and making sure that everything is done just so, does this religious, does this concern for detail bring about more cases of OCD or the like in the religious population?
Very popular question. I would say probably unlikely. Can't say it for sure, but what I can tell you is if a person has a tendency towards OCD and obsessions and therefore as a result engages in compulsions to try to tone down the anxiety that comes along with the obsession, then it will affect the areas that a person finds most important in life. It's not the religion that makes the OCD. It happens to be people tend to find religion important to them. Other people find health very important to them. Some people find concerns about numbers to be extremely important to them. And therefore, we have different subtypes of OCD. In the case of scrupulosity, we tend to see it more in our population because, thank God, we have people who are concerned about religious ideas. But that doesn't mean that it always brings on OCD. It's not the religion that's bringing it on. It's the religion that has an environment that the person cares about and is taking to an extreme.
Very, very interesting. Okay, once you've discussed a little bit of, you know, how OCD manifests itself, you know, what other ways are there in which OCD manifests itself? You know, there are definitely stereotypes of someone washing hands time and time again, running to check if the door is locked. Is that really the way OCD manifests itself? Simply an example, but misleading as a definition. What are the different ways in which, you know, in as you mentioned, that OCD manifests itself differently? What are some of those different ways?
Good question. So as we mentioned before, and what we should be picking up by now is the understanding that the OCD is about anxiety. It's about a thought that comes up that produces an anxiety. And as we just finished discussing, that anxiety can be in a number of different areas. For some people, it can be an anxiety about contamination. I don't want to get sick. I don't want to die. And so therefore, I have anxiety about it. Some people have anxiety about doing and checking. Sometimes people are concerned about what we call symmetry OCD. Everything has to be perfectly aligned or else something magical is going to go bad. Once upon a time, we talked about hoarding OCD, where a person was afraid of the idea that I may lose something that will one day prove to be valuable. Under the current guidelines of the DSM, hoarding is its own subsection. I don't think it makes it any less OCD, and there is concern there within. Sometimes OCD seems on the surface to only have obsessions. They don't only have obsessions. The compulsions are being done in the mind as well. We call that pure OCD. There's something called HOCD, where a person is so concerned about his or her gender identity that he or she is constantly checking to make sure that he or she believes 100% that he or she is heterosexual. But the idea is so all-consuming to the person, and the fear of not being sure is so overwhelming that people can't handle it. Each one is a distinct subcategory. The concerns, the thoughts, the obsessions that bring them on are different, and therefore the anxiety is different, and the compulsions that come out as a result are different. It's rare to see major jumping between one obsession and another. I like to tell my patients, OCD is a lazy disorder intellectually. It doesn't like to jump. If you're in a contamination mode, a lot of your obsessive thoughts will be about contamination. If you're in a religious mode, what we call scrupulosity mode, once you nail your theme, it's going to work in the same way.
Perhaps related to this, we got a question asking if you can talk a little bit about reassurance seeking. Why do people do it, and what is the correct way to respond if one has a loved one who's always seeking reassurance? Maybe it's even a teacher who's dealing with a student who's always seeking reassurance. Can you speak a little bit about reassurance seeking?
If you are nervous all the time, what's the first thing you want to know? Everything will be okay. Don't worry. Everyone will be fine and everyone will be okay. Now, if you're dealing with an OCD or even an anxiety where you can't tell for sure everything's going to be okay and you're constantly checking, your child is constantly asking, but mommy, is it fine? But mommy, is it fine? Are you sure it's fine? How do you know it's fine? The short term is the understanding that, wow, my mommy will make sure everything is fine. But the truth of the matter is, reassurance doesn't always stick. And therefore, a thought can come off in someone's head. Rabbis, we deal with this all the time. I'm sure you understand that, Rabbi Zatz, when somebody will call you with a question. Rabbi, is such and such okay? And the person will turn to you and say, okay, you'll get his or her answer. And then they'll say, but what if this? And then you'll say, it didn't make a difference. And then the person will say, but maybe, Rabbi, I'm not sure I heard you right, or maybe you didn't hear me correctly. And after a while, you start to realize the person is asking constantly to make sure that everything is fine. What's really going on behind the scenes in the person's mind and the child's mind is that the person has a thought that won't let go. Allowing the reassurance to come from the outside prevents the opportunity for the person to develop his or her own coping mechanisms. Those coping mechanisms, dealing with the doubt, is such a major component of OCD treatment. Reassurance holds it back. We want to try to avoid that. in our context and in our degree.
Okay, thank you so much. We got a question. Can you talk about pandas?
I think you mean pandas. Okay? It's okay. It's okay because I'm about to... Okay. I'm going to embarrass myself because it's pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric disorder as a result of strep, if I'm not mistaken. It's pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric disorders associated with strep. And basically, very often on the surface, PANDAS very much looks like, sounds like, and makes noise like OCD. But it's really different. Some of the major differences that you'll notice is as opposed to the OCD in its traditional sense, which seems to have a more gradual onset, when we start to suspect PANDAS, we're talking about a sudden onset and a sharp increase of the OCD. When you're looking at a PANDAS case, often you'll see tics or a certain hyperactive, irregular movement of the arms and the legs. You'll notice some irritability. You'll notice that the child who may be not just a regular classic OCD case, but rather this PANDAS condition is reverting back to a younger developmental stage. Person seems to have, your child seems to have a nighttime difficulty, severe nightmares, new bedtime rituals. And it's all really quick, and you're starting to ask, how could it have moved that fast? The answer is, I often wonder out loud, and I've actually had this case on my own block, where the child had an undiagnosed strep, or that the strep was diagnosed, but it never left the body. And what wound up happening is that the strep affected the body and stayed inside. And this PANDAS disorder associated with strep looks very much like OCD. It's treated very differently. It's treated with severe antibiotics. We're lucky in the Jewish community. Dr. Susan Schulman in Brooklyn happens to be one of the world's experts on PANDAS. So a number of years ago in my own community, in my own shul, two people on my own block began the sudden onset of OCD. My congregants know that although I won't treat children in my own community, I certainly am there to provide advice. And both parents came to talk. And I recommended that they go to the pediatrician and get a strep test. And so the pediatrician got really upset. PANDAS is not agreed to in everybody's mindset. And so they came back and said that your rabbi is crazy and he should stick to sermons. My suggestion then was to get a hold of Dr. Schulman. And in both cases, lo and behold, the strep tests were positive. Lo and behold, the children were suffering from PANDAS. And when the strep was treated properly under the care of Dr. Schulman, all of a sudden we saw a rapid decline in the intensity and severity of the OCD symptoms. It's very important to rule out medical conditions. It's also important to know what's there in order for us to be able to do so well. It's important to pay attention and to work with people who make us feel comfortable. You are your best advocate for your children.
Okay, thank you. I've now been educated on PANDAS as opposed to the animal. Maybe changing gears slightly. You know, if I have a loved one who is suffering and anxious when it relates to certain things, am I helping him or her by trying to shield them from that which makes him or her anxious? Or is that just avoiding the realities of life and pushing off the inevitable and perhaps holding them back from being able to deal with whatever they're going to need to deal with at a later stage?
I have two rules in my practice. There are two usher words. One is reassurance and the other is avoidance. Because those two words are, those two sins, so to speak, are what I call Yeharik Val Yavor. That said, there's a time and a place to introduce new steps, and there is the right environment, and it's parents or spouses or loved ones. We need to know how and when to engage. But we need to also understand that if we take our children out of situations that they're suffering with anyway, it doesn't make the problem go away. The anxiety is still there. It's just not in front of us in the exact moment. It's okay to avoid a situation when we're not ready for it, but it's not okay to allow that situation to be avoided forevermore. And that's part of what developing a good, healthy treatment plan is all about, knowing how to handle.
Many of the questions that have been coming in by email seem to address adolescents or younger children. How would you propose to address a young man who has displayed obsessive-compulsive type behaviors through adolescence, however, was not open to therapy? In addition, is it possible to exhibit several OCD symptoms at the same time?
Let me answer the second question first. It's definitely possible to exhibit several OCD symptoms at the same time. It's the themes that tend not to cross. But the symptoms, absolutely. The reason behind them, the underlying fear, the underlying thought process is the thing that I was referring to before. However, in regard to somebody who's not open to therapy, I'm not exactly sure what age range we're talking about. Life presents challenges. And life steps present challenges. If we pick up our children and we throw them at the therapist, or we try to insist that they take medication, then our children are going to rebel against us, and we're going to have challenges, and we're not going to be able to function. On the other side of it, if we don't encourage and then we don't help the children come to understanding that there's a lot of positive in getting work, and here's where stigma and some of the wonderful work you guys are doing with Project OMETS really plays an important role. Helping children understand that, wait a second, we can deal with this. As far as we're concerned, anxiety disorders and OCD may be more prevalent in society than other diagnoses. They're also some of the most treatable disorders. They don't have to be long-term. They don't have to be debilitating. They don't have to leave life in disorder. What children need to come to understand, and especially when they hit stages as late adolescents and early young adulthood, understanding that dealing with these things now helps them move through life. You're not saddled because you're dealing with OCD. You are a hero. You have strength, and it will help you move on, and it will help you become a stronger person, ultimately a stronger spouse, and hopefully a stronger and more reliable parent for dealing with your concerns and your anxieties. These ideas need to be fostered within our children. Being able to move around further when you're in college or you're away in yeshiva or you're in seminary, instead of being debilitated and stuck, afraid to make a phone call so that you can go out for Shabbos when you're in college or when you're in yeshiva in Israel, all of a sudden provides more opportunity. Can you imagine how difficult a date would be if you're constantly thinking about the fact that you may turn red? Doesn't really look very good if you're afraid to speak up on a date. Working on these things makes you stronger. Helping our children come to understand that we can do these things and encouraging them to play the lead, to play the role, help select a therapist. These are good ideas to help people get to the stage that they want to help themselves.
No, thank you so much. Often the focus and a lot of what we've been talking about thus far has rightfully been on the one who is ill or who is suffering. And sometimes overlooked are those trying to be supportive of a child, a spouse, even a parent or a sibling. What should and shouldn't they do in their role of supporting their loved ones? And how should they care for themselves? How should they make sure that even though they're trying to be supportive at the same time, they have to make sure to do whatever is necessary to keep themselves in a healthy state?
This is probably the most important question because it's the one that gets overlooked the most. It's the one where, as parents or as siblings, we realize that we get sometimes regulated to the back. The person who's dealing with his or her challenges is up front, is being encouraged, not reassured, but encouraged, is being told what a hero he or she is, and they are. But what about us? What happens when our day gets ruined because we have a child who's afraid to get into the car and it's a sibling? What about the parents who are dealing with questions about their own anger at God, perhaps, or guilt or shame, or loss of the child that you expected to have and coming up with the reality that the child that you're dealing with? for these situations, I think it's important for parents especially, and siblings as well, to set certain self-care plans, to take time out and understand themselves, to seek the time to get encouragement, to get the energy, and also to be able to put these emotions in their right place, to develop a sense of understanding, to find support groups. If you're embarrassed, to find them online, to handle calls like this one. And that's, again, one of the great, beautiful things about what you guys are doing, to know your own limits and to know your own strengths, and for siblings to realize that they're not secondary. If it's my birthday and it's my trip and my sibling is not going to be able to get in that car and go on that trip, then what we need to do is develop an alternative plan so the siblings don't wind up resenting one another. At the same time, it's also important for siblings and parents, et cetera, when we're working with a treatment plan, not to overdo it. So sometimes siblings can get that way. You may be working on something and we're not allowed to reassure, but that doesn't mean we have to make fun. And so helping children understand that their brother or sister can use the benefit of the role. Don't do the exercise for the person working on his or her challenge, but certainly be encouraging. Sometimes using humor can go really, really far and can certainly help bring down tension in family situations. One last point, take breaks. If we're always in hostile situations because the anxiety level in the home is high, because somebody is having trouble with an anxiety, or somebody is having trouble locking horns on an OCD, sometimes we all need to just take a break, take a step out, step away from the situation from time to time, so we can turn around and handle it again, so we can approach it with more energy, with more enthusiasm to keep working together.
It's an interesting question, and I can certainly relate to it from different roles in the community. And that is, are we collectively putting too much pressure on our kids? Are we seeing an increase in cases of anxiety that, again, there's so much pressure and so many concerns and worries and colleges and scholarships and so much going on in our children's lives. And, again, there's so much of a pressure that's put upon them. Are we maybe not just not doing our part in relieving it, but maybe we've created a society or a system in which we are really putting too much pressure and somehow increasing their anxiety?
I want to say yes, but only because I think that would just make my question easier to answer. The answer is, my guess is no. It's a question of impression. Sometimes the answer can be yes. It's what is the child taking in? What is the message at home? What's the message in school? I often think that there's a very big difference between a message of you need to be perfect versus you should strive for excellence. I think it was the Malbim in HaKarmel who made the comment that, you know, we never talk about tamimus, about something being tamim, unless it's an animal. A human being is never tamim. An animal is tamim at what point in time? When it's ready to be brought as a korban. It's ready to be shechted. Great. what good do you have the next day? I think and I wish and I often have tried to communicate both in my personal life to my kids, hopefully, but certainly in my practice, that we want to encourage people to shoot for excellence. Do the best you can. Put in your best effort. We'll take it. We'll take it at that level. And I think that that's something that we also need to discover in our children as well. And that message has to be echoed in our schools, in our shuls, in our college admissions boards, and certainly in our homes. If the kids are taking the pressure on themselves, then we need to do our best to create a pressure-reducing valve. My mother always used to joke with us, maybe we were all supposedly too high achieving or focused. She would say to us, fail the test every now and then, it's good for you. I don't think she actually felt too good when we did that, but honestly, it did send a different message to us, to take pressure in context. The pressure of life should be, am I living it to the best way I can, not am I living to be perfect. Nobody in life can live to be perfect. Moshe Rabbeinu himself declares on the last day of his life, Lo uchal od latzeis v'lavo, I don't have the ability to get any further. I've done what I can, and now I'm ready to pass on. He certainly was excellent, but Moshe Rabbeinu was still a person. And if that's good enough for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, for him, it should be good enough for our kids as well.
Okay, thank you. If a child is in treatment for OCD, is it best to share with the siblings or to keep it private? And I guess as a, related to the same point is what should I be sharing with my child's school and teachers? Is it necessary for them to know the child's diagnosis in order for them to help best educate and help the child grow?
Two great questions, and they really come down to the same issue, which is what's the benefit? What's the benefit, and what's the potential downfall? And again, that question has to be discussed between the parents and the child under discussion. Where is it going to be helpful to the child? Where is it going to be hurtful to the child? Unfortunately, teachers are not perfect, and neither are siblings. And sometimes an excuse, well, the child has anxiety, prevents the child from being able to achieve success. Maybe the teacher does not expect more from the child and fails to allow the child to demonstrate his or her true excellence in a situation. We would call this the opposite of the halo effect or the devil effect. We don't want to encourage that, but at the same point in time, sometimes having a school aware of what a particular child's anxiety or OCD is about, if it's in the trust of safe people, if it's in the trust of a situation that can be monitored and work together, then we are achieving what we call the school-shul-home partnership. And that's a very important thing to be able to raise our healthy kids. The same goes through for the home. As far as the home is concerned, sometimes you have to figure out which siblings are going to be able to understand this better. And determining what language to use when describing whatever the condition may be for the siblings is always going to be important. The question is, will it be something that will be beneficial or something that will be hurtful? How much? How little? What necessary? What not necessary? These are questions that have to be dealt with on individual specific cases.
Okay. Thank you so much. Just, I think the hour is starting to get late, and you've really touched on so many different topics. Maybe just as a closing thought, maybe you can just share with us what other resources are available for people who are trying to help a loved one, again, with dealing with anxiety or obsessive compulsive disorder.
The good news is there are a lot of good resources. This is and a lot of them are free, and a lot of them have no need for personal disclosure or personal identification. There are support groups that are available on the Internet. But in New Jersey, we're blessed because we have the New Jersey IOCDF, or the New Jersey chapter of the International the International OCD Foundation. They have monthly meetings in different parts of New Jersey open to everybody where different speakers come, and there are opportunities for people to speak, to learn, to share, or just to listen and sit in the back quietly. They meet quarterly in addition. Then those meetings are a little bit more intense. But each opportunity helps somebody realize there are a lot of good people out there. Its president, Alan Wegg, is a great guy and has written a lot. In locally, we have the New Jersey Psychological Association, very, very aware. But, you know, you mentioned Relief before, and Relief Resources provides such a background. And thank God, even in our secular, in our presses, in the Mishpacha magazines, and the other sorts of magazines that we're getting from home, we are being exposed to the understanding, and the community is being exposed to the understanding that people who are suffering from anxiety and people who are suffering from OCD are perfectly terrific, normal people, and their conditions are indeed treatable. We point out at the end of our Chaim Tov La'avodas Hashem B'Simcha. We make appointment to say it's always good in life to serve Hashem B'Simcha. V'agila b'ra'ada, the joy has to be combined with a certain sense of reverence and a certain sense of concern. But at the same point in time, hara'ada b'gila, the shuddering and the fear has to also include with it a sense of contentment. It's good to have a sense of awareness where a person sits within his context of avodas Hashem. But at the same point in time, it's important for a person to remember, Ivdu es Hashem ultimately is b'simcha. It's ultimately a process that should not be anxiety fulfilled and doesn't have to be, not for us and not for our children.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Dr. Schwartz. I apologize that we were not able to get to answer all the questions, but I think that we've really been exposed to a lot of crucial information, and really thank you for your time and your effort and all of your insight, and wish everybody a tremendous hatzlacha in all their endeavors and dealing with whatever it is, and only should be able to be on the road towards happiness, towards what Rabbi Schwartz mentioned, this Ivdu Hashem b'simcha. Have a wonderful evening, and thanks for joining us.